All right, it's a real honor to be here, and I know that there are a number of browser vendors in the room, so I almost wonder if they're more qualified to give this talk than I am, but I'm going to make a good show of it, and maybe we'll embarrass them later on. So how many of you have read the book Crossing the Chasm? I see only a few hands up. So a lot of people have heard of this book, and not that many people have actually read it. I skimmed it like a week ago because it was in the title of my talk, and I figure I might as well understand what the book was actually about. And it pretty much matched my expectation. So this is a book that's about how to take your startup that is getting some early adoption, some early interest from users, and make it into a mainstream product that you can sell to millions of people and really turn into a $100 million or billion dollar business. And there are tons of startups that never make it across the chasm from the innovators and the early adopters to the early, late, and laggard majority, which constitutes most of the market for your product. And it turns out that it's very easy to get stuck at the various gaps in the bell curve that is the users of your product. You can get stuck trying to go from innovators to early adopters, but the place where you're most likely to get stuck is going from early adopters to the early majority. Because the things that the early majority want, the people who are going out and buying iPods a few years ago, nowadays you're in the laggards if you're buying an iPhone, but the people that are in the early majority typically want different things than what the early adopters want. And so if you listen very carefully to what the early majority is telling you to build, you'll build something that you'll never be able to turn into a large company. So it's important to not always listen to what people are telling you that they want, and instead think about how to take your idea to make it even bigger than it already is. So I've been on a lot of program committees in the last year. I was on the program committees for the top four security conferences. So I see a lot of research papers go by, and a lot of them are web security research that is really interesting. A lot of it, I think, has some potential to change the world and the way that people browse, enable types of applications that were never before possible. But this stuff, most of it will never get deployed. Most of it will never make it in the hands of real users. And you know, I have some examples on the left of the Gazelle browser, the Tahoma browser, and the OP browser, of browsers that probably never made it past 10 users. They were in some research lab, and if you wanted to get it outside the company, maybe if you're lucky, they released their source code, and you could compile it yourself. And that's about as far as that proposal managed to go. So there's a huge gap in terms of numbers between the innovators and the early adopters. There's actually a lot of early adopters that are out there on the internet. And you can find them because they're running extensions and add-ons to their browser. They may not be technical, they may not be able to modify their browser behavior themselves, but they're willing to try out new stuff, and they're willing to cope with breakage, and they're willing to do it because they like having control over their web browsing experience. And that's great. If you come up with a new feature and you can make a million people happy with it by getting it into an add-on that's on the Mozilla add-ons gallery, the Google Chrome add-ons gallery, or you get it implemented in NoScript, or one of these other popular security add-ons, you know, you're making a difference, but it's important to know that you could be making a much bigger difference if you were building a feature for browser vendors to implement into their core product. And the kinds of requirements for a security feature to make it into the core product of a browser are very different than what you need in order to make it into NoScript, for example. So I'll talk about that a lot more during this talk. And I have suggestively put IE in the late majority, but I think I'm actually going to walk back from that a little bit because as we're going to see in this talk, they've actually been leading the way in many places on security and coming up with some really bold proposals, causing a lot of pain and breakage for users at the same time to force the world forward on security. And so really I should say that these browser icons are placed in terms of the users of the browser. Chrome and Firefox users tend to be a little bit more on the leading edge in terms of updating their browsers more often and taking a more active role in managing their browser, whereas IE and Safari come pre-installed on your system. And then, of course, if you're using Internet Explorer 6 because your company makes you, it's going to be a very long time before you get any benefit out of any security research proposal you might see here at Usenix Security. But we can try to change that, and we have. There are research proposals that have been proposed at conferences like this one and made it into IE6. So don't be afraid to shoot for the moon. Okay, so I have been working with Google on a project called the BrowserScope project, and the goal, and you can go to browserscope.org and see this right now. It is a project that's tracking some of the security features that browser vendors have implemented in the last few years, and seeing which of these features have gotten adopted very quickly, which of them are really struggling to get adopted, which of them are stuck on a single vendor and no other vendor is willing to pick it up. And you can get historical data for thousands and thousands of browsers. The way that this site works is when you go there, you click the button to say run the BrowserScope test, and then it'll analyze your browser and see what features work and what features are missing. And of course, I'm focused on the security tests, but there's a huge number of different tests that are on the site, whether it be for your ACID test performance, your network selectors, also all sorts of different features you can try using this website. But I've only put a small selection of security features on here, about 17 security features. And these are the ones that are doing the best out of thousands of ideas that people have had and hundreds of serious proposals that have made it onto mailing lists and even through standards bodies. And many of these are still mostly red, meaning that most browser vendors have not picked it up. So are these browser vendors just lazy? I mean, there are clearly lots of great ideas out there. Why isn't it the case that browser vendors are moving more quickly, and why isn't this entirely green? You do want a secure browser, right? I mean, you know, who would download an insecure browser? Well, it turns out that browser vendors actually do move very quickly, but they move quickly only when the idea meets certain criteria that make it an instant candidate for getting into the browser. And I just wanted to highlight two examples here that I think are examples of ideas that got into browsers very, very fast. And it used to be that, you know, in this long gap between the release of IE6 and IE7, that we were convinced that the browsers would never change and the web was done. And Firefox is the only browser to save us by continuing to innovate. But I think that's totally changed now. I think every browser vendor is releasing a new version as fast as they can. Obviously, IE is moving a little bit slower than some of the other vendors. But you can have an idea that gets put out there, and 2 years later, you got a complete green on BrowserScope. This idea is an opt-in feature that every browser vendor decided was a good idea and is now in the hands of web developers to use. So that's the X-Frame Options feature. And there's another feature which has made it into every the latest version of every browser. It's not quite on Android yet, which is the history privacy feature. And this is something that's only a year old, so it's really remarkable that a complicated feature like history privacy was able to make it into browsers that fast. So what differentiates these two features from the hundreds of other research proposals that have been proposed at conferences like this one and aren't getting adopted? So I'm just going to give you a few examples of ideas that I just see papers about over and over and over again. And I know that these are ideas that a lot of people in this audience would really like to see implemented. I see Benedita in the audience has been working on identity in the browser, and that's something that I've seen so many papers on. People really want it to happen, but it's extremely hard to do right and in a way that every browser vendor will be willing to jump on and do the same way. Another idea that I just see in so many different research papers is this idea of trying to sandbox web plugins. You are running all of this untrusted code on your computer that has tons of bugs and is extremely likely to cause damage to your system if you visit an untrusted website. And so you'd like to be able to run that code in a sandbox so it can't damage your system and it can't do anything bad to other websites on your computer. It's really running in a lockdown sandbox. That idea has been around for a really long time. I think at least 15 years, you can go and see papers about trying to put plugins in some kind of fine-grained sandbox. But you still see a lot of major browsers that are shipping plugins running completely fully privileged. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think that one of the reasons is that plugins are often used to push the limits of what's possible in browsers. And so if you put them in a sandbox, then by definition, they can only do what the sandbox allows them to do. And another feature that I would love to see but hasn't really made its way into any major browser is defense against these clickjacking attacks, which have been come to prominence in the last few years and are relatively easy to pull off attacks that affect lots and lots of websites. So you can use clickjacking to force the user to click buttons on other websites and cause them to do bad things to their account, like delete their account. So I'm going to claim that this clickjacking protection hasn't made it to cross the chasm. And it probably won't. At least none of the ideas that are out there right now have a chance of it. And you might push back at me and say, you know, hey, Colin, don't you know there's ClearClick and it's in NoScript, and there's some crazy number of people that have downloaded NoScript, probably because I heard about ClearClick. I think I looked at the numbers, and according to the addons.mozilla.org gallery, there are 90 million people have downloaded the NoScript add-on, which is just a staggering number. That's larger than the population of a lot of countries. So clearly there's a demand for this feature, and yet it's not getting adopted by any major browser vendor, and I haven't heard anyone who's told me that they have plans to. So is NoScript the mainstream? It's not, I claim. And I think NoScript is actually a dumping ground for a lot of features that probably will never make it across the chasm, because there needs to be some way for users that are enthusiasts and want to take control of their browser experience to feel like they're protecting themselves and feel more control over their user experience. But this is the type of feature that's too sophisticated, and it's not right for a mainstream audience. So NoScript has a fundamentally different outlook than mainstream browser vendors. NoScript is okay with extensive user interaction. NoScript can have highly complicated algorithms that the correctness of the algorithm is very hard to analyze. And because there's not that many people that are trying to attack NoScript, it's not such a big deal if a flaw is discovered, because the author can just, you know, release a new version and everyone will auto-update and everyone will be happy and no actual damage is done. There's not a large enough user base for people to design attack websites entirely around getting past NoScript. But if you're a major browser vendor, the story is very different. You actually need to make sure that your feature is going to be robust to attackers that are spending every single day of their lives thinking about how to get around it. So it's not okay for the feature to be highly complicated. It needs to be very easy to verify as correct. And finally, NoScript is willing to break websites, and that's just that's its role. I mean, if you run NoScript in its default mode, it actually disables JavaScript entirely on the web, and you have to enable it manually for the websites that you want script on, which in my mind is just crazy. The idea that websites wouldn't be able to provide you with JavaScript and still be useful is hard to imagine as a web developer. I just really think that this whole model that you have to trust a site until in order to use it is the model of software pre the web. I mean, the idea that you bought a box on a shelf in a store and installed it on your computer because you trusted the vendor of that software not to mess up your computer is something you just don't have to do today. Today you can go to any website and experience that website in its full and rich functionality without having to know whether or not the author is some hacker who's living in Russia or whether there's somebody who's living in San Francisco. It doesn't matter. The browser sandbox is designed to keep you safe. So NoScript is a very different approach to security. And if you switch off of its default mode and go into the allow scripts by default mode, then you're browsing the web in a slightly more sane environment where websites can all do basically what they want to do. But the NoScript is going to break the web, and it's going to break it in ways that no mainstream browser vendor ever could. So after just telling you why NoScript is not mainstream, I would like to say that I think that the add-on has a very important role to play. And it's maintained by one guy, and he's a really great guy, and we have lots of public arguments on Twitter, and you should donate to him if you want to keep him interested in maintaining NoScript. So that's his profile, if you want to donate. Okay, so are browser vendors too conservative? Why aren't they picking up features like this built-in clickjacking protection? I mean, right now, this very moment, there is a clickjacking attack going on somewhere in the world, and someone's money is being stolen or their tweets are being tweeted without their consent. And browser vendors are just sitting idly by because they don't have an automatic defense that they can offer users. But I don't think that they're wrong to make that decision. When you're adding a security feature, it's not free. It's extremely expensive, even if the implementation might appear to be simple. If you're adding any sort of user interface to the browser, then that's extremely expensive because a lot of browsers are using simplicity as a selling point. They really want to give every pixel of the screen to the user so that they can view the content of the website. And they want to not interrupt the user with lots of security warnings. They just want the user to get to where they want to go. So if there's a feature that you think that some small fraction of your user base wants, but everybody else can deal without, that's exactly what add-ons were created for, and that's what the browser vendor's first reaction is going to be if you propose a feature that's going to break the web. So breakage is very expensive, and I think that that's the other perspective that browser vendors really are keeping in mind. Websites take a long time to adapt to changes in the security model of browsers. And so once you change a website and cause it to no longer function, then probably the user is going to be out of luck for a very long time before that website will go back to being functional. And probably what they'll have to do is angrily tweet about it and then go switch browsers. That's really the only option that they have. And maybe they'll come back, but they're always going to remember that this is the browser that didn't render their favorite website. So everybody's seen the warning that says your browser is not supported where the website refuses to let you use the site. I can tell you that that's one of the most infuriating messages that I've ever encountered on the web. Especially, it's even worse if they tell you that your browser's too old when you're using a brand new browser that came out. Anybody seen that? Okay, so what I'm going to claim is that what you're doing when you're writing a research paper for a conference like Usenix Security is very different than what a browser vendor is looking for in a feature that's going to be deployed to billions of users. And what program committees are often looking for in the review process is they're looking for novel work. It's not substantially similar to previous work, so there's really some new idea here. And the idea is going to be opening up new avenues of research. Maybe it's creating a whole new field. Those are the papers that get cited. And the papers that get cited are going to be considered to be the most prestigious and interesting papers for posterity. And so top conferences are looking for that kind of work. And oftentimes you'll see that program committee members talk about wanting to see work that's unconstrained by conventional thinking, that's bold. It pushes beyond people's preconceptions about how a system should be built. And that stuff is all great, but it's terrible if you're building a browser, because browsers are designed for the web, and the web is very large, and it exists already. And if you really push beyond the way that people have a mental model for what's going on, they're going to have a really big barrier to adoption to using the system. And the other thing that program committees often look for in the review process is non-trivial systems. So the system is making clever use of some advanced tools or techniques. It's building on other research papers. There's substantial work that was involved in building the system. It's not just a three lines of JavaScript or something like that. And that's especially important, I think, in systems conferences. But if you're a browser vendor, that's the opposite of what you want. You want ideas that are as dead simple as possible. You want to strip away all the clutter, all the user interface. You want to strip away as much as you possibly can and just get to that kernel of security benefit at the bottom. And so while these things are going to get you a good conference paper, I think they actively harm the proposal's mainstream appeal. So this isn't to say that you shouldn't do non-trivial novel work, but you need to be aware of that when you try to do a technology transfer into a real browser. Okay, so what do browser vendors care about? So here are three things that I think browser vendors care about. And I suspect that during the Q&A we'll hear about a bunch of other things that they also care about. But I'm going to try to give you some examples of these. And I'm going to give you some real-world examples of research papers and other proposals that either met or failed to meet these criteria, and try to argue that that's why they got or did not get adoption. So the most important thing is that your proposal is useful. It's a must-have feature that browser vendors just absolutely must put into their browser. They've got so many different ideas to choose from, so many different ways that they could be spending their time when they're developing a browser. And if you're trying to decide what to work on, you want to make sure that you're working on things that people actually care about. And if the proposal is an idea that it's clear there's a lot of interest in because people are already trying to implement this in a broken, band-aid, ineffective approach, then that's a very good sign that this is something that you could provide, you could step in and provide much better. I think what's actually really important is that no browser wants to be the one browser that doesn't have some critical security feature, because then people are going to start writing negative news articles about them and talk about why this browser is inadequate. So having a must-have feature is good, but the feature, if it's a feature that everyone really wants, but it's just really hard to do, it often still won't get adopted by every browser vendor. And so there's something that I'd like to talk about, and I'll go into more detail on this, but it's really nice for features to be deployable unilaterally. So it doesn't require a lot of conversation and agreement among different browser vendors, different websites, and everybody have to come together and standardize it in order for it to get used. Really, you'd like to have only a single moving part, and that's the person who originally deploys the feature. And then it can start to be used by other people. And it should be easy to build a feature in a way that's easy to determine if it's correct. And then finally, and this is, I think, something that a lot of research proposals ignore, it needs to be a low-risk feature. And by low-risk, I don't mean that attackers are going to come in and poke holes in it. I mean that it's not going to break stuff that people want. And that is incredibly important for making sure that your feature gets used. And there's a lot of different strategies you can use to de-risk your proposal. Okay, so I'm going to give you some examples of making a proposal a must-have. So you might have this idea for some new security behavior that you think is better for browsers. Maybe you're going to introduce a new authentication mechanism. You can always find somebody who will say, oh yeah, that's a good idea. I would install that. They might even install your add-on. But that's not a surefire sign that your feature is actually going to be something that people need in the mainstream. It may be relegated to add-ons for the rest of its life. So in order for browser vendors to get really excited about it, it helps a lot for you to get one browser vendor on board. Because browser vendors are like dominoes. Once you have a few of them knocked over, the rest of them don't want to be the browser vendor that's missing that feature. And so they'll cave. So if you can market your feature in such a way that nobody wants to be the browser without it, that helps a lot. And another thing that helps is to have some really compelling demos of why this feature is necessary. So security features often are motivated by attacks. So if you can argue that there's a theoretical attack, but the attack's not really that exciting, nobody wants to hear about it, then that's not a real good sign that the browser vendor should change their behavior. But if you can make a really compelling demos and people are writing mainstream press articles about it, then it's starting to get into the public awareness, and that's going to get vendors much more likely to drop what they're doing and pay attention to what you have to say. And then finally, if you're building a feature that involves website involvement, getting large websites to champion it and announce that they're going to support it can make a big difference in terms of people taking it seriously. So I'd say the number one must-have feature, and this is a very old one, and I would love it if Brandon Eich, who I think is in the audience, would tell us the true history of this feature. But the number one must-have feature, of course, is the browser same origin policy. And this is the policy that controls how the browser allows access in terms of one web page trying to communicate with another web page. And if you didn't have this policy, it would be extremely hard to do anything safely on the web, because the minute you logged into one website, another website would be able to hijack that session and do whatever it wanted. So when you're designing a feature, if you can make it as must-have as the same origin policy, then you know you've really hit the jackpot. So the same origin policy says that one web page is allowed to access any web page that has the same protocol, host, and port. So if you're on google.com and you want to access google.com/search, that's allowed. You can make a network request for that document, or you can access a frame that has that URL. But if you are trying to access yahoo.com, that would not be allowed because the hosts don't match. So there are limited ways that you can interact with other origins. It's not really a strict policy. And this is the source of a lot of confusion in terms of people designing security research around the idea that browsers are a completely same origin model. You can actually interact with origins in lots of different ways. You can load library resources like scripts from other origins. You can load images. You can embed iframes. You can create forms and hyperlinks that send data to other origins. There's nothing in the browser that stops that. And there are new proposals that have been pretty widely adopted now for even allowing full network access as long as the website gives you an opt-in permission. So there are other features that have become must-have features. And I think that the story for how they became must-have features oftentimes involves one browser vendor saying, hey, I'm going to do this, and then everybody else saying, well, I guess, you know, if they're doing it, we'll do it too. So PostMessage, I think, was one of those features. It was a feature that was originally introduced in Opera, I believe, and it was introduced in response to people doing some really ugly stuff in order to allow communication between different origins. So if you're in a browser, and if you're a web page in a browser, and you want to talk to Yahoo and your Google, it used to be that the only way to do that was to make a network request, like a form post or something, and round trip everything through the internet in order to send that data. And that's really, really annoying and slow, and it led to people building these really bizarre systems that tried to take advantage of quirks and hacks in the browser in order to get that message across the boundary that the browser was enforcing the same origin policy. And so rather than forcing websites to build these incredibly complicated systems that ended up having huge security vulnerabilities, browser vendors introduced this new feature that allowed you to send a message to anybody that you want, and you know that other document that's receiving the message can either accept it or drop it. So there it's very much a, you can communicate to anyone you want, but they can verify who they're getting the message from. A very different model than the same origin policy. So it was something that a lot of browser vendors were interested in, but weren't sure whether or not it was really safe, because nobody had built any systems around it. And so eventually Microsoft decided that they were going to be one of the first non-Opera vendors. And I guess I'm being mean to Opera by not including their logo in any of my slides. But Internet Explorer decided they were going to stand up and do it because, you know, it seemed relatively safe. Nobody had found any serious security problems with it. And then once Microsoft got on board, Firefox was trying to finalize, I believe it was Firefox 3.6? Anyway, some recent version of Firefox. And they decided to put on the development roadmap, even though the browser was months and months delayed and they're in its beta, because that they wanted to have feature parity with Microsoft on HTML5 features. And this is something that a lot of web developers had been asking for. So even though they weren't really sure about the security of it either, they decided to jump on board just to make sure that they weren't falling behind IE. And then Safari wanted feature parity with Internet Explorer and Firefox, and the dominoes all fell, and everybody decided they were going to adopt it. And we had actually discovered a few months earlier this vulnerability in PostMessage. And we were like really excited about PostMessage and didn't want people to say that it's unsafe and refuse to implement it because it would set back progress years and years. So we decided to withhold our knowledge of this vulnerability until we'd seen every browser vendor commit to doing PostMessage on their development roadmap. And then we dropped the bomb on the working group. At just the last moment, we got everybody to change their protocol to add a new parameter to PostMessage for security. And because at that point they'd all committed to doing it, they didn't feel so bad about keeping it, even though it had some security issue. And because nobody was really using it yet, because not all the browser vendors had deployed it yet, it was possible to change the API and not completely break the web. So this is a very rare opportunity that doesn't come along very often, where you can come in at just the right time to change a feature. If you came in too early, then you might scare people off from using it entirely. If you came in too late, then you wouldn't be able to change it because it already had deployed. So I think I'm going to reiterate this a few times during the talk, but there's a lot of really interesting stuff being standardized right now. And as researchers, there's a very narrow window when you can come in and make a huge difference on a feature before it starts to become too expensive to actually deploy your fix. So I'll give you some suggestions for things that I think are interesting to look at now at the end. So another feature that I just mentioned as an example is history privacy. So in the last year, every browser vendor jumped on the David Barron defense for history privacy. So the attack here is that a website wants to know what web pages that you've been to. And so there's a trick that the website can do in order to try to query your history. The website essentially creates a bunch of hyperlinks and then uses the JavaScript API to check the color of the hyperlink. If the color is blue, then that's a URL that you have not visited. If the color is purple, then it's a URL that you have visited. So there were some real websites that were doing this. YouPorn was one of the Alexa top 100, and they were using it to query what your porn interests were on other websites and show you relevant content. So that was something that a lot of people felt very uncomfortable about and actually led to a fairly major lawsuit, which I believe has been settled now. So that sort of media interest, mainstream media, real money quantities changing hand over attacks that are going on, is the sort of stuff that gets browser vendors very interested. Another thing that made a big difference, I think, was that people started to make more and more compelling attack demos. You know, this attack had been known for more than 10 years, I believe. and nobody really had come up with a good fix for it. The fixes were all really painful and complicated, and so a lot of people just sort of wanted to keep thinking about it and find something better. But the attack demos got better and better, and it got to the point where websites could really de-anonymize you and figure out exactly who you were and every single website that you'd been to. The way that this history hack works, you can't actually enumerate all the sites in the user's history. You have to query individual sites one at a time and see whether or not you get a yes-no answer for each one. But browser JavaScript engines were getting so much faster that it was actually getting to the point where you could query every website that anyone would ever want to go to and still be able to do that in a reasonable amount of time. So there was a solution that eventually emerged that was a partial solution. It didn't completely solve the problem, but it solved it well enough. And because this feature was so must-have, it very quickly got adopted by all the vendors. Okay, so you've got a feature that everybody wants. It's solving a need that people are solving in a horrible, hacked-up way right now, like they're clearing their history every time they turn on their web browser just because they're worried about YouPorn sniffing their history. So now, what do you do to make your proposal easy so that browser vendors will be willing to implement it? So I think it helps a lot if your proposal is deployable unilaterally. If your proposal doesn't require a bunch of vendors to all agree at the same time to do the proposal, because there's always some organizational friction when you have multiple people working on the feature in different places. And it's also nice if the feature doesn't require the browser vendor and the website to both agree to use the feature in order for the feature to get deployed in the browser in the first place. And I think that it's also really helpful that you can implement it in a standard way. It doesn't require a lot of creativity or help from the architecture of the browser. And there are a number of features that I think are really interesting from a research perspective, but are still pretty far away from making it into crossing the chasm to mainstream browsers, because they are extremely complicated to do correctly, and browser vendors are looking for easy wins. So I think taint tracking is probably something that falls in this category. There's been a lot of people have been exploring taint tracking to secure JavaScript and web pages, prevent them from doing things with data that they shouldn't be able to do. But that's really hard to do right, and there's lots of covert channels of browsers and other sorts of strange ways that information can propagate. And so that sort of proposal tends to fall down, even if it's something that everybody wants, because it's just too hard. I think Microsoft has recently released, I think in Internet Explorer 8, this two static HTML feature. And that's a feature that can take any string and make sure that it doesn't have anything dangerous in it after you call this API. What does that mean? I mean, you could change your mind on a day-to-day basis about what sorts of stuff you want to sanitize in two static HTML, because there's so many things on the edges of dynamic on the web. Anyway, SVG content, animated GIF images, CSS. So that's an example of something that you could try to standardize, but I think it would have to change a lot over time as the web evolves. And so it's not an example of an easy feature, which I think is why no other browser vendor has picked it up. And then I think DNSSEC is probably the ultimate example of a security feature with just tons of moving parts and lots of different people that need to agree on how to do things in order for it to get used. You need to have both the domain owners and the people that are running the infrastructure agree on how it's going to work. And that's why it's taken an extremely long time. So in terms of easy, let's compare the X-frame options clickjacking defense to ClearClick. So on the left, I have a picture of what the X-frame options looks like. And you can see that there's this web page with a cat and an iframe. The iframe is, say, the delete your account page on Twitter or something. So when you click on the cat, because it's some sort of cat clicking game, I guess, then you're going to actually end up deleting your account. But Internet Explorer has blocked the attack, and instead they're showing you an error page telling you that this web page cannot be displayed in an iframe. X-frame options is an API that this website is using, the website that's in the iframe, to block being iframed. So an iframe is a way to include another HTML document in an HTML document. And not everybody wants to be in an iframe, because you could be a sensitive page with lots of very sensitive buttons that you don't want the user clicking unless they know what they're doing. So a clickjacking attack just involves making an iframe and tricking the user into interacting with the page, not knowing what they're getting themselves into. So X-frame options, all the website had to do was send a single HTTP header that said, hey, I don't want to be iframed. And sure enough, the browser is blocking it. It's not being iframed. ClearClick, on the other hand, is designed to be an on-by-default security mechanism. So ClearClick is trying to protect a website even though the website doesn't know that it's being protected. And that means that it has to try to protect any website, even if the website does want to be iframed. So ClearClick is doing a funny thing where it tries to figure out whether or not the user can see a sufficient region of the web page to understand what's going on and that there's no pixels overlaying the region of the page that they're clicking on. And then if it looks like there's probably an attack, just to make sure, NoScript will prompt the user with this dialog. And I don't know about you, but I really have no idea what to click on if I were to see this dialog, especially if I didn't think I was being attacked. Probably most of the time you see this dialog, nothing bad is going on. So this is an example of a complicated solution to a problem and a simple solution to the problem. Clearly, there are some advantages to ClearClick. I mean, ClearClick is on by default, so it's protecting all sorts of websites that haven't bothered to think about click tracking. But I think there's a reason why X-Frame Options got implemented in 2 years, and there's no way that ClearClick ever will. So another example is the strict transport security proposal. This is a proposal that came out of my research group when I was at Stanford. And originally, we called it the Force HTTPS. The idea being, you know, I spend a lot of time browsing the web on insecure networks, and a lot of websites support HTTPS, but they don't use it all the time. So what if there was just a way to push a button to make the website always secure? So at the time, it was a very user-configurable feature. You, as a user, decided, yes, this is a site I want to use securely. And we were using cookies to store your preference. We added a bunch of other features that we thought were useful, like preventing the website from including resources insecurely. Turns out that the proposal was way too complicated. What actually got standardized is much, much simpler and doesn't include the mixed content protection. That was actually a request that we got from the Firefox team because it was too complicated in their architecture to block mixed content, but they still wanted to implement the core feature. And so now it's an opt-in feature that servers can use to say, I'm an all HTTPS site. Please don't ever talk to me again on HTTP. So we've gotten that into Firefox. It's in Google Chrome. It'll hopefully be adopted by other browser vendors as it's now going through IETF standardization. And we also got a really great champion, PayPal, to get behind it very early on. Google also got behind it. They're now using it for almost all of their apps. So if you're using docs.google.com, mail.google.com, you're using a Force HTTPS domain. So try to go to that URL on HTTP, I dare you, in Chrome. You won't be able to. Okay, so finally, how do you make your proposal low risk? So this is a really important consideration that I'd say the research community ignores the most. And there's lots of things that we might mean when we're talking about low risk. But really, the visualization that I would use is, are people going to come with pitchforks and make angry noises because you just broke their favorite website, you just broke their favorite thing, they can't get any work done? Are you creating more pain than you're creating happiness in the world as a result of developing this feature? So there's three strategies that I can think of to de-risk a security proposal, to make people willing to get behind it. So one is you can make the security opt-in. So this means that X-Frame Options isn't going to work unless the website knows that X-Frame Options exists and turns it on. That's a huge evangelism cost. You have to go out now and find millions of websites and tell them, hey, you need to add this new HTTP header. It's one more thing to do when you're setting up a new website. So another thing you can do is create a brand new feature, a new ecosystem, and then just by virtue of participating in an ecosystem, you are going to get that new security functionality. This is a very rare opportunity. You don't get it very many times in the life of a browser. But when you do, you should really think about whether or not there are ways to take advantage of the fact that you've dropped all of your legacy considerations and you're creating an entirely new API. And then finally, if you can't do number one or number two, and you have to break stuff, or at least make observable changes to behavior, then you need to do a very thorough performance and compatibility evaluation. And I think the standards for what browser vendors consider to be thorough is very different than what a researcher might consider to be thorough. So I'll give some examples of what I think is thorough. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about opt-in security. I think the most common approach that people take to opt-in security is just propose a new HTTP header, propose a new HTML tag, propose some new thing that people can use if they want the extra security, and you can just ignore it, and that way you can be pretty darn confident that you're not going to break anything that's already out there. So with HTTP headers, it's actually getting kind of ridiculous. If you go look at google.com and open it up in Firebug or in the Web Inspector, look at the HTTP headers, you'll see that there are just so many X headers now that Google has to send you to opt out of content sniffing, to opt out of being loaded over HTTP. There's XSS filter, which Google wants to disable. There's just a whole bunch of different things that you might want to send, and that's extra network bandwidth on every request. So this is a problem that's been slowly creeping on us for years, and it's kind of like the user agent problem. I don't know if anybody's looked at the user agent string of your browser, but there's this extremely long and extraordinary history of how that string has evolved. It just keeps adding more and more stuff over time, because when anybody introduces a new browser, they have to pretend to be some other browser that everyone else is using, because otherwise you're going to get blocked by all the websites. And so that's actually starting to cause some performance impact on websites, which is one of the reasons why header compression is such an important feature for web browsers to have, so that at least when you send that user agent string, you're not sending the same bytes over and over and over again on every request. So we have one of our foremost experts on header compression in the audience, so maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that. Okay, so how many opt-in features have had an impact on the world is, I think, an interesting question. Certainly, features like the content security policy, which is another mechanism for deploying security policy, got a lot of support from Twitter, and I think that made a big difference in terms of getting mainstream browser vendors interested in it. And I think it'll be a long time before millions of websites are going to use these new headers that are getting introduced, just because it's one more thing to do, and people don't update their websites very often. I think the vast majority of websites that are out there are not really being maintained. They've just been set up, and people are relying on them to stay available and to continue working, but the developer who wrote them has moved on. So that is a downside of an opt-in feature. One thing that's kind of cool about content security policy, though, is that it solves the header bloat issue a little bit. You now have a single header where you can specify your policy, and it's creating one place for people to configure all of their security stuff. So the primary use case for content security policy is cross-site scripting defense, and that was really the must-have reason why everybody wants it. But once you've got this general policy delivery mechanism, you might as well just throw all of the other research ideas that you can think of into it. And because it's opt-in, you're not really going to have as much of a security impact or compatibility impact on existing sites. So if you're not going to do opt-in, you might want to just make your feature mandatory, but make it part of a new platform. So Google has introduced their new App Store and their extension model, which is something that was completely new a few years ago. And because they were introducing an entirely new API, they could force people to do things in a way that would make it easy to secure. So they created all of these boundaries between the different processes that compose your extension and forced people to write their application with asynchronous APIs. So there's a great research paper out of Berkeley and Google that talks about how they designed this API to enable privilege separation and least privilege. So if you are finding yourself designing a new system like this as a browser vendor, then I think that's a wonderful opportunity. You should take it. As a researcher, you may find it pretty hard because you don't get that many chances to introduce something new to the world and get millions of people to use it. If you did, you could probably quit your job as a researcher and go hang out on an island in Tahiti. So I'll give you another example of something that was new that came in at just the right time to change it. So the WebSockets protocol is something that has been under standardization for, I think, a few years now. And it's basically a way for websites to talk to each other without having to use the HTTP protocol. Not websites, but a client JavaScript and a web server. So the idea here is that you don't want to have the overhead of all this HTTP stuff, and you want to have long-lived connections. You might want to make a real-time game like Quake or a chat client. And so WebSockets give you a really nice way to communicate over the network. But because you're not using the HTTP protocol and you're talking directly over a socket, there's a lot of concern that there may be weird assumptions the network is making about the fact that they think you're talking the HTTP protocol, but you're actually not. And that was something that we were really concerned about when we started to analyze it last year. And what we found was that there's actually some really funny things that web proxies can do to mess with your traffic. If they think that you're sending cacheable network requests over the wire, they may actually cache things that look like HTTP responses, even though they're completely communication between client-side JavaScript and some code on the server that isn't an HTTP server at all. So the way this attack would work is the user visits some malicious website, attacker.com, and then the user gets served up some JavaScript that opens up an HTTP connection to attacker.com and sends what looks like an HTTP request, but it's being sent over a WebSocket. And the server is going to reply back with an HTTP response that the proxy is going to interpret and throw into its cache. So now that HTTP response looks like to the network cache to be an HTTP response for some victim website, target.com. Now when you go to target.com, you're actually going to be served up the cached resource, and you're experiencing the attacker's content instead of the real target.com content. So that's a fairly simple attack to pull off as long as the user is behind a vulnerable or malicious proxy. And we did an experiment that showed that there actually are these proxies that are out there. And the exact number of them is somewhat unknown. But if you can poison one of these caches, then you can affect everybody who's behind the proxy and pollute their traffic. So we mentioned this to the working group and said, you know, we think there should be some sort of encryption or masking that makes it hard for the proxy to interpret the request and response as legitimate HTTP traffic. And the browser vendors are all like, yep, I guess that's something that we should fix. And it just so happened that we were at the point where WebSockets hadn't been fully standardized, and they were planning to make a few more tweaks to the protocol anyway. So the browser vendors all decided to yank support, although I think Chrome kept it for a little while, and go back to the drawing board, come up with a proposal that involved masking. And the masking is pretty annoying, honestly. If you're building a WebSockets implementation, there's some performance overhead to it. It's just one more thing that you have to unscramble when you're building a packet sniffer. And it doesn't provide any security benefit other than preventing these proxies from getting unconfused. And so there were a lot of people that were really mad at me and my research team for announcing this vulnerability, because we were essentially holding WebSockets hostage for 6 months because of some hypothetical buggy proxy that we had found using an ad network experiment. And at the time, I felt kind of bad. To be honest, I was pretty excited about WebSockets, and I had hoped that we were going to be able to do what we did with PostMessage, where we just sort of dropped this security vulnerability at just the right time that everybody would be like, okay, we'll implement it and we'll move on. But the vendors thought that cache poisoning was a lot more serious because it affected existing legacy applications as opposed to just new users of a new API. So they pulled the feature. Now it's back, and you should use it, and it's awesome. It has the new security mechanism involved. And it turns out that there's been some new attacks that have been discovered on older versions of the WebSockets protocol before we came in and proposed the masking. So I now feel like we probably did the right thing by introducing masking, because the proxy vulnerabilities that we found were just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of other weird stuff that can go on. But that was a bit of a surprise. For a long time, I really regretted writing that paper. So if you're not building a new feature or ecosystem, and you're not making an opt-in feature, you want to protect everybody who's out there, even if they've never heard of you, then you're building on-by-default security. And that is really scary, because when you break stuff, things are going to fail in mysterious ways, and the people that are going to be sad are people that have never heard of you. For every person that actually goes and files a bug against your browser and says, hey, my favorite website broke, there's going to be hundreds, I think, of people that are just going to give up and just turn off their computer and be sad that they can't access the internet today. So I'll give you a couple of examples of how this has affected me personally. So I was taking a Korean class at Stanford a couple years back, and we were using Flash Player to do all of our exercises. And coincidentally, at the same time, I was working with Jeremiah Grossman on some really interesting Flash Player research. We found that it was possible to attack Gmail by causing it to host a Swift file. So a Swift file is basically a Flash movie file that was crafted by the attacker. So the way this attack works is essentially you get the website to host your Swift, and in the case of Gmail, you basically get Gmail to send it to someone as an attachment, so you know the URL of the attachment. And then the user logs in to the victim website and then goes to the attacking website at the same time. This is a very common assumption that we make in web security, where the user is going to bad websites and good websites and lots of different tabs in their browser. And then the attacking website, all they have to do is create an embed tag pointing at the malicious Swift file that has been hosted on the victim domain. Now, according to the Flash Player security policy, if you're hosting a Swift file, that Swift file is like an iframe. It's got full privileges of the origin that's hosting it, and so it can read all of your Gmail, can delete your account, set up a forwarding filter, do all sorts of bad stuff. And so this is something that Adobe decided that they were going to block. And the way that they blocked it was by saying that any Swift file that's hosted with content disposition attachment is probably a Gmail attachment and not a real Swift file that should be rendered in the browser. So just download that Swift file to the hard drive instead. So we thought that was pretty clever, and we got really excited about it. We blogged about it. Turns out this completely shut down my Korean class, because whoever had written the website hadn't bothered to tweak Apache to remove that content disposition attachment header. And so none of the Flash movies would play anymore. Flash Player thought, hey, this must be some kind of Gmail attack going on, so I'm going to refuse to play the Swift movie. And so for the entire summer, we had to go to some old computer that had really, really old version of Flash Player, and we hadn't upgraded it yet, just in order to play the Flash Player movies. Essentially, we were choosing to use the insecure version in order to get the functionality that we wanted to get stuff done, because we knew that we weren't actually under attack. Now, I think Adobe did the right thing here, because nowadays you can't build a Flash Player website that doesn't work in Flash 10, so you're going to have to realize this while you're building your site. But this caused a lot of pain, and I'm pretty sure we weren't the only classroom on the planet that was using Flash Player to do their audio exercises. So another, I think, example of a security mechanism that's probably destroying a lot of value, may even be destroying more value than it's creating, is the Online Certificate Status Protocol. So this is a protocol that browsers use to check the validity status of certificates, see whether or not they've been revoked or not. And for 10% of HTTPS requests, that validation can take over a second. And this is a really critical time to be making an HTTPS connection, because you're visiting the site for the first time. You're probably coming in off of a Google result. Maybe it's a shopping cart website that wants to sell you some stuff. And now the browser's got to wait 1 second to load the main website, and then it's got to wait 1 second to load each of the subdomains that are hosting static resources in the site, like JavaScript, style sheets. So now we're talking about multiple seconds being added to the page load, all just to check whether or not this certificate is valid or not. And you know, the certificates are already issued with an expiration date. So browser vendors are going to get in big trouble if they don't support OCSP, because the certificate authority industry has put a lot of energy behind making sure that it's a requirement for extended validation and all sorts of things like that. But most browsers aren't really strictly enforcing OCSP anymore, because it's so likely that the certificate responder, the server that's set up by the certificate authority to say whether or not the certificate is valid or not, is going to be slow or offline. It's extremely common that that happens. There's a paper in Black Hat a few years back where they talked about how you could just, if you're a network attacker and you're like a malicious wireless network, you could cause the browser to accept any certificate that was revoked simply by impersonating the OCSP responder and returning the number 3, which stands for try again later. And the number three apparently was the all you needed to completely disable this security feature, because no browser was willing to block a website just because the OCSP responder was currently offline. And I'm very happy that you are. I think that this is an example, and maybe we'll hear some other viewpoints in the Q&A at the end, but an example of a feature that was doing more harm than good. So you're writing a research paper. How are you going to evaluate your proposal? Well, here's three examples that I've actually seen in research papers recently for their compatibility evaluation. So what's wrong with I checked the Alexa top 100? I mean, 100 is a large number. It's three digits. It's what do you mean when you checked it? And usually what it means is that you went to the home page and you loaded it and you checked to see whether there are any security errors in the logs. But it turns out that web pages are a lot more than one web page. Web pages are, or websites are a lot more than one web page. They involve thousands of web pages, many of which you can't even get to without logging in. So another example is you're trying to improve the plugin security model, and you decide that Flash Player is the only plugin that matters, and the only thing that people ever do with Flash Player is play YouTube videos. So if you can play YouTube video, then it's A-OK, doesn't break the web. Well, YouTube is one of the least interesting from a security perspective, because it's basically just doing what plugins are supposed to do, which is play media. But there's lots of things that plugins can do that really push the limits of what's possible in a browser, like going full screen or using your camera or accessing other parts of your operating system. So if you're designing a plugin policy, you're guaranteed to be breaking that stuff. That's exactly what plugins are doing that they shouldn't be doing, but they are because that's what people want. So if you're not evaluating your compatibility against that, then you're not evaluating your compatibility at all. And then finally, what your standards are for exactly what constitutes an acceptable breakage should be a lot lower than 20%. Ideally, those 20% of websites that are broken are going to be a lot of noise to the browser vendor, and they're basically going to be spending their entire day dealing with complaints from people that can't access their stuff. Because when you're a browser with 100 million users, that 20% means that your support staff are going to be overwhelmed the entire day, if you have a support staff, which most browser vendors probably don't. Okay, so here's some evaluations I've seen that have seemed more reasonable to me. So if you can do a deep crawl, that's really good. So try to go into more pages than the home page. And if you can, try to access the parts of the website that require JavaScript, because there's a lot of things you can do that a crawler can't really see. There are several options that you have for measuring whether or not your security change will break anything using browser opt-in user metrics. So both Google Chrome and Firefox have opt-in user metrics that they've made accessible to researchers in certain ways. So basically, when you install the browser asks, hey, do you want to participate in making this browser better? And if the user says yes, then there are anonymized stats that are sent back to the browser vendor periodically about your browsing habits. And you can design experiments around measuring things that browsers are doing to see whether or not your change will break the web. So Chrome has one, and the Chrome team has been pretty good about releasing their data when it's they can do so in a way that's respecting user privacy. And then Firefox has this opt-in test pilot studies that I think if you install a Firefox beta, you automatically get an opportunity to join test pilot. And they're actually really looking for interesting experiments to run on their test pilot framework. And then another trick that I like to do to run experiments in people's networks is using ad networks to run arbitrary code on people's browsers, well, not arbitrary code, but JavaScript code on people's browsers, and test the limits of what's possible both in their user agent and also on their network. So this is how we found the WebSockets vulnerability, but you can also use it to see whether or not your proposal for a security feature is going to break new proxies or things like that. We've used this, for example, to test to see whether any proxies are blocking the content security policy header in Firefox. And there aren't any that we found. The header tends to get passed through unchanged. Okay, so here's a paper that I think is a good example of evaluation. So this is the content sniffing algorithm paper by Adam Barth, Juan Caballero, and Don Song. So they searched the Google crawl index the entire internet. to see whether or not there were any examples of where their proposed change would break anything. And they used that to eliminate any content-sniffing rules that weren't being used by any websites. They had a QA team that went to the top 500 websites. It is a three-digit number, but it's a lot more work to actually send a person to log into the site, create an account, log in, and go to every web page they can find and make sure that nothing breaks. So that was, I think, a significant step above the having a crawler visit 100 sites. And then they actually did a user metric study on Google Chrome to see whether or not their change would break any websites. And they found 0.004% compatibility impact. And so that I think is a number that's a lot more palatable to browser vendors than numbers that are greater than 1%. So not all of you work at Google. So I think Adam and Dawn were working at Google at the time they wrote this paper, so they had access to a lot of stuff that they wouldn't have otherwise. But if you don't have a Google index, you can crawl a heck of a lot of web pages just using your web browser. So my student David ran a compatibility evaluation for a change to the way that browsers process style sheets. And we managed to hit 100,000 websites without too much trouble on a single laptop. It turns out if you've actually looked at the top 100 websites, a lot of them are really sketchy. So a lot of people were asking him what he was doing with the network at the time we ran the study. But what we found is that there are two policies that we proposed, and one of them would break 74 out of the 100,000, and the other broke zero. And so we just put both of those options in the paper, and different vendors did different things. What I'd recommend, though, is to check out TestPilot. I think it's actually really interesting for a research group like the Usenix community to run experiments on. And you can put just about anything, any arbitrary code, in your TestPilot extension. Of course, people would prefer if you didn't install malware on their machines. And so the TestPilot reviewers will make sure your add-on is well-formed. But we use this to measure a proposed change to the way that applications are isolated, to see how many entry points that websites actually have, to see whether or not we could prevent cross-site scripting. And we found that some websites had a very large number of entry points, and it was very hard to sort of lock down the places where you could enter that website. And other websites had a very small number of entry points. So that's an example of something we could run, and we looked at millions of links without us having to do anything, without having to convince anybody to participate in our study, and the users didn't even know, really, that they were running the experiment until the browser asked them to report the results. So sometimes when you run a compatibility evaluation, the answer is no. Don't do it. And I wish that I had concluded that on some of the previous papers that I worked on. The Safe History paper is a paper that tried to propose a solution to the visited link problem, where essentially you change the color of hyperlinks to be always blue if you detect that making the hyperlink purple would cause a security or a privacy violation for the user. So we constrained that policy as much as we could to make it as tight as possible, but it still had to break functionality. So if you did a search for using security on Google, and then you did the same search on Yahoo, the link wouldn't show up as purple, even though you had visited it. And you know, that's a break. That is an example of a feature that should not make it out to end users. Maybe no script can do it, but browser vendors couldn't. And they didn't. They adopted the David Barron defense instead, which I think was right. Even though there are some holes in the David Barron defense, which we presented at Usenix Security, at Oakland, about. Okay, so if your numbers aren't good, there's one thing that you can do that will really solve your problem. And I would say this would not be something that I would expect, but every once in a while we're pleasantly surprised. Every once in a while, Internet Explorer just comes in and saves the day. And here's how they do it. They just decide they're going to break the web. And then now, if IE is doing it, everyone wants to be sort of following IE. So they've already taken the compatibility hit. So it's not such a big deal anymore. So I think I'll skip over this one because I don't have enough time. But mixed content is one example where Internet Explorer has decided they're just going to take the hit. And how many of you have seen this mixed content dialogue? This is a version from, I think, Windows 2000, but this warning has been around since HTTPS was invented. And it basically means that the website is trying to include some JavaScript insecurely. Everybody knows that that's a problem. Like, you shouldn't include insecure JavaScript in your HTTPS page. That just means you're going to get hacked by a network attacker. But lots of browser vendors either show this dialogue or they just put a slash over the lock icon and just allow the request to continue. That's not safe. So the browser's same origin policy only cares about scheme, host, and port. And so if it's got a web page that is served with completely secure contents and a web page that's served with some insecure JavaScript, those web pages have full access to each other. The one on the bottom can inject script into the top one, you'd never know. So the real solution to mixed content is not to put a slash for the lock icon. It's definitely not to add more UI. It's just to block it. Maybe you give the user a way to get the JavaScript to run again, but it should be way out of their face. And Internet Explorers decide they're just going to blaze the path on this one. And they've decided to put this, they've announced they're putting this in IE9. And I think now that IE is doing it, Google Chrome's taking a much closer look. It's definitely something that I think is going to break a lot of stuff. It's going to create a lot of pain. And I would say without IE championing this feature, it probably would never happen. But because they've decided to take that leadership role, sometimes you just got to take one for the team. Okay, so just to wrap up, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking about how to make your research proposal cross the chasm and become mainstream. But you know, a lot of you are trying to come up with interesting research to work on. You might be prematurely optimizing if you're thinking about how to build a mainstream feature. And I've told you three things that you need in order to make a mainstream feature. But does that mean we shouldn't think about things that aren't must-haves but are just nice-to-haves? What about things that are difficult to implement or things that are risky and might break stuff? Should we just forget about doing all of that research? I don't think so. I think that that research is actually really important. But you should be prepared for browser vendors to pick apart your idea and just extract the bits of it that they want. And so I've seen a lot of examples of papers that are incredibly complicated, bold new solutions that break the web, and then just little nuggets of ideas get pulled out of them by browser vendors and implemented. And so some of the best ideas, I'd say, are the ones that can be easily tweaked and repurposed and pulled out of your complicated system. So just to give you two examples, the Perspectives project, which was at CMU, proposed creating this notary server infrastructure that keeps track of all the certificates that people are seeing on the internet. So Chrome has now got a DNSSEC equivalent of Perspectives that your browser queries when you browse around the web to see whether or not it's getting the certificate that it should from the websites that you visit. And if you've got opt-in user metrics enabled, it's reporting back to Google when you see a mismatch. Well, it will at some point, I guess. Adam has told me that. I don't know whether or not it's actually true. Yeah, it's behind a command line flag right now, but I think this will get more widely used. But this is an example of a mainstream browser vendor picking up something and doing it in a very different way than it was in the original research paper. And that's great. Like, there's so many differences between the two proposals, but the idea was there. And in the end, the Firefox add-on for Perspectives is never going to get to mainstream adoption. But this is a chance for you to get something in the hands of millions of users. And I think that ultimately that could help us find rogue CA attacks and all sorts of other attacks. And just to give one other example, so there's a paper that I wrote with Helen Wang at Microsoft called Mashup OS. And you know, the paper was a really complicated system that didn't really go anywhere in its original form, but there were two ideas in it that did actually make it their way into HTML5. And every time I talk to Helen about Mashup OS, I have to remind her that you know, just because it didn't get adopted in name and in form doesn't mean it wasn't a successful paper. But if I were to write the paper in the future, I would have cut out most of the complexity and focus on the core ideas that I think are most interesting. Okay, so I know that I'm supposed to leave some time for questions. I would say that you know, here are some examples of interesting problems that I think researchers should jump in and take a look at now because they're at just the right stage for researchers to revolutionize the form of the proposal and find interesting security vulnerabilities. So if you really want to make a difference, these are some of the ones that I would say to Google them, go look it up. Here's some mailing lists that you can join, What Working Group, W3C, Public Web Security, and there's two IETF mailing lists that I would say would be very interesting for people who are interested in making a difference in web security. And we do have a bunch of Mozilla people here. I think there is one Chrome team member that I've seen. There's probably more. So these people are here, and you can meet with them at Usenix Security and ask them how you can help. So I would encourage you to do that, because it turns out they're really nice people. And then finally, there's nothing that says implement me now, like a patch, like if you've already done it. And a lot of these open source browsers, it can be a little bit intimidating to get up to speed on when you first get in there. But you can learn a lot by actually implementing your feature, or at least taking a first pass at it. And I promise you, the reviewers won't bite. They'll just rewrite your patch from scratch. But it doesn't hurt to give it a try. OK, so I'm Colin Jackson. I'm based on the Silicon Valley campus of Carnegie Mellon University. And I'd love to have a few questions. So anybody want to jump up to the mic? Thank you. Thanks. Yeah.
Hey, I really liked your talk, first off.
Thanks.
But I guess I had two questions.
Huh?
The first is, like, I feel like a lot of what you talked about today is making it okay for me to play in an unsafe playground. I think that we've lost sight of what a lot of responsibility the client is for. Because it's like, if you're going to go to evil.com and expect it not to be evil, I think that you're just like kind of an underwhelming client. How much of that do you think is the client's responsibility, and how much do you think we're trying to implement less than adequate or less than elegant solutions to kind of clean up a child's mess, so to speak?
Well, so I think I would say that I don't really agree with the NoScript model for the internet, which is that the internet should be totally devoid of functionality until you decide that you trust the website, because I think that as an application developer, I would like to be able to rely on providing a certain baseline functionality to every user, regardless of how much they like me. And so I think it is the challenge of a browser vendor to try to build a sandbox that will run websites without users getting hurt, no matter how bad the person who wrote the website is. So I think the web is really the greatest success story for sandbox code that the world has ever seen, and we should embrace that. I think that if we go to a model where the user has to agree to a long list of permissions in order to get a website to do what they want, then that's sort of a failure, and that's not a scenario that I would like to live in.
Right. I guess to rephrase, and this is kind of like my second one, like,
yeah.
Do you think that if this website, like, you know, the example you listed is kind of like, you know, YouPorn, for example, if it has a bad reputation of, you know, that, then why don't users just stop going to that? And if the website's never visited, it's not really useful. I guess that's my second question, is what responsibility do we have as users to say, oh, this website has a really bad reputation, let's just stop going there. We don't need internet browsers securing us from it, we just need to stop going there and force the web developers to make secure content or not hijack our privacy, or else we're just going to stop using them. I guess that's...
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could imagine sophisticated users being able to make that decision, but if you're trying to build something that's going to work for a billion people, then I think it's got to be something that you can do automatically.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks. And by the way, if you could say your name, that would help me a lot.
Oh, Austin.
Austin, yeah.
Hi, Colin. This is Pratik.
Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of good things in the talk. One of the things which I was very intrigued about is we talk about these, you know, deeper testing techniques and sort of, you know, how do you do a better evaluation? Do you think we should spend more effort into creating benchmarks for, like, you mentioned one or two of these examples?
Yeah, absolutely.
But is there a place we can go and really say, hey, you know, I'm running this research now. I would like to really test it out.
I really want Mozilla to release their page load test somehow. I know that there's copyright issues around it, but it's the best benchmark that exists, I think, for a lot of performance evaluation. And maybe there's a new one that we should come up with now that, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of copyright issues. I think that that's the main reason why the benchmarks haven't been released by any one vendor, just because you have to run it on the real website in order to not run into the problems of copying their stuff. But absolutely, I would think that that would be hugely valuable, and I would definitely be interested in research around the creation of performance benchmarks or compatibility benchmarks.
Yeah, maybe more research papers on that area. Very interesting. Thanks.
Thanks.
Hey, Colin. Hey. This is Ben. Great talk. I can't emphasize enough how right on I think you are about the way that that you have to test your proposals on the web. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of security paper submissions, is that there's an ecosystem of the web, and you just have to assume that it exists as it is, and you have to test it as it is. And I think the work you've done, and Adam Bart has done also, and a few others, really crystallizes that. So if you're writing a paper and you want to learn how to test your stuff on the web, read papers by Colin and Adam. I have one question for you, since, hey, you know, I'm with a browser vendor now.
Yeah.
What's the top two things that you'd like to push on us and tell us to, hey, look at these things that you're not looking at right now. You've got the microphone, so what should we be doing?
I mean, I'm sort of feel like I'm not really the right person to say that. I mean, I think ultimately I would want to go to somebody like PayPal or a large website and say, what are the problems that you're seeing? Or talk to users and see what they're seeing. I mean, I have some ideas, but of features that I would like to see get more adoption faster. Like, I'd like to see everybody deploy strict transport security. I think it's crazy that FireSheep still works on most websites. But, you know, I know that these things take time. Thanks, Ben. Oh, and by the way, here's some controversial things that I just said. So if you're trying to come up with something to grill me on, you can start with these.
Hi, Colin. This is Ben.
Hey.
So I can quite believe I'm saying that, but why don't we, you know, let the invisible hand of the free market decide some of this? Which is to say, to rephrase it, is it possible to maybe market based on security features, or for that matter, privacy features? I mean, if I understand correctly, you know, Google Plus was recently marketed in part based on their privacy features. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think that certainly there's a lot of free market competition that goes on among browser vendors, where one of them will introduce a feature and then others will have to decide if they want to copy the feature, whether that feature is not worth copying or actually a negative. So I think like Internet Explorer tried to compete on privacy in some of the latest releases with the smart screen. And I think it's great to have that competition going on. I think there's some perverse non-market behavior that also happens in terms of you know, everybody wants the world to be a safer place, even if it's not always in their best interest. And so that's why you sometimes see browsers like Internet Explorer take one for the team and take what's certainly to be more of a compatibility hit than any other browser in terms of the pain that their users are going to experience. So I think that it's good to have. And I think there's a lot of other ways that markets exist. So, for example, for add-ons, you know, if you have a good idea, you can put it in an add-on and you'll see how many people install it. If only 5 people install it, maybe no one cares. I do want to caution against being too user-centric in the early stages of a proposal, because the difference between 100 users and 10,000 users is not actually that significant for a researcher, because the chasm is much further along. When you get to about 1 million, crossing it into 1 billion is the real test of whether an idea is mainstream.
My name is not Ben, it's Brendan.
Hey.
Hey, great talk. A couple of things. You asked about Same Origin. I created that a long time ago, and I don't remember all the details, but I did make a lot of holes in it, as you noted, because it was important to load images and other resources cross-site, and I thought scripts should be the same, which is, I think, one of the things advertising and analytics depend on these days. So
yep.
I'm kind of glad I did it, even though it's kind of horrible. The timing and other channels that are blinded by the CSS David Baron fix, you mentioned it spread quickly, but he worked on that for years, as you probably know. Some of these things just take a long time to find the sweet spot.
He did. I think that everybody worked on it. I know that I was part of the bug, which is probably one of the longest bugs in Bugzilla history.
Bug 147777.
Yeah.
It runs to 281 comments.
How many of them are mine? But yeah, so we all worked on it, and it was a collaborative effort, and there were many other proposals that were discussed on various mailing lists that weren't as good and didn't get adoption. So I think that people weren't not interested in the feature, they just couldn't handle the compatibility impact and the difficulty that these other proposals had. So it moved very quickly once it met the three criteria of being must have that is easy and low risk. So I think that that's the reason why I think it fits in this sort of framework for thinking about deployment.
A couple more things. You asked about post message. That was in Firefox 3.
Okay.
And you're right. IE8 gave it a big boost. It was great that Opera did it. IE has taken for the team some hits. And with market share the way it is, they're not the only one that can do that now, which is kind of nice. We have more balance. The last thing is about OCSP. Your point about adding changes that are opt-in that don't break anything and that you can then start winning points with somehow in some game and get other browsers to adopt is good, but OCSP bites back. I think even Google's not able to, you know, require OCSP responders to be available. They're worried about Gmail not being available.
Exactly true, and that's why I am going to argue that OCSP is a failure. It was a feature that got adopted too soon, and it didn't actually have the properties that browser vendors want. And I think I would even argue that it hasn't really been adopted. They're half-heartedly checking it, but then they throw away the answer. So.
Yeah, well, X.509 PKI never worked, so we can just stop there.
Yeah.
You could require that your CA authority actually maintain an OCSP server that doesn't suck, but no one does that. On that note, people who worry about user adoption, people will like it or not, users are very irrational beings. Most researchers don't seem to realize that unless you deal with human interface kinds of things.
Yeah.
They will tell you all day they want something, they would love it, and the minute it makes them click one extra time a day, they'll turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
So I cannot emphasize enough how much the make it easy, make it not break things really, really matters to people. I work for Dollar Bank, and the dollar value people place on these sorts of things is basically nil. The marketplace will not do this. Users say they want it. They don't. They're not willing to. They want it for free. They're not willing to have any extra hassle, inconvenience, or anything. It just doesn't work.
I couldn't agree more.
And my last comment is, please learn to pronounce the name of the words in the title of your presentation. It's chasm.
Okay.
Okay, Dan Wallach, Rice University. It is chasm, but that isn't what I wanted to ask you about. One of the controversial things that you said that other people here assume, it's not up here, but I still think it's pretty controversial.
Yeah.
You said that we really like this idea of this one-size-fits-all security policy, and I think the countervailing thing is our phones with, especially Android, where would you like to accept any of this long list of, oh, whatever, okay, sure.
Yeah.
So the question is there... Everybody says that the phone, that apps and the web are converging somewhere. Can you pontificate about what that somewhere might be? And
yeah, so I think you can look at the way that the apps model for the Google Chrome is evolving, and you'll see that it is converging on some sort of weird amalgamation of mobile security and web security. So soon, when you want to use Google Docs, you will have to give it clipboard access by adding as an app, or you can anyway. And when you do that, your Google PowerPoint presentations, which I'm using to present this, by the way, will not suck. You'll actually be able to use the clipboard instead of it being blocked for security. So I think it'll be very interesting to see whether or not combining all the permissions into a single dialogue is going to be better than having no permissions UI at all, which is the way the web has worked until now. There's actually a lot of new HTML5 features that have started to create info bars, like the geolocation API. Local storage, requesting more storage, things like that. So I think it's going to be a necessity that we eventually combine those into a single prompt. But it does make me a little sad. I really like the fact that the web just works, and you don't have to think hard about security every time you browse to a site. So maybe some researchers will come up with a good way to sidestep that.
All right, well, I'm going to put on my IT organizer's role, a hat, and make a brief announcement. So there will be an invited talk tomorrow morning. The original speaker was employed by Verizon, which apparently is a hazardous thing when they're having a strike. So our new pinch hitter, awesome speaker, and I encourage you all to come to this room tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., is Tara Whelan from the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada. And she will be speaking about, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, perspectives from a privacy tech wonk. So that's my brief announcement. I don't think, any other questions? All right, well, thank you very much, Colin.
Thanks.